Dokken, Friday, 5th December, 1980. There is a peculiar superstition held by the majority of mankind that the living of a religious life means to be more or less miserable. To regard existence here on this planet as something altogether undesirable and unworthy. Now, it would be difficult to find a worse mistake made by people. The great founders of the religions and all the true spiritual teachers of the world have always pointed out in perhaps not too openly, but more or less have emphasized the fact that the living of the religious life is for the sake of man's happiness and fulfillment. And let us have no illusions about that. Let me quote to you what some of the great teachers have said. One of the Upanishadic teachers, Sanat Kumara by name, and his name means the ever virgin youth, the youth of 16 summers, Sanat Kumara. He's teaching his pupil and he says, "The infinite is immortal, but the finite is mortal. The infinite is above and below, north and south, and east and west. The infinite is the whole universe. Where there is the infinite, there is joy. There is no joy in the finite. Only in the infinite there is joy. Know the nature of the infinite." And if he says that the infinite is the whole universe, that means joy pervades the entire universe. If only we knew how to put ourselves in tune with it. That is what he says. Now, one of the great teachers of the Rig Veda, which is the oldest religious monument of the Indo-European race, the Rig Veda. The great teacher, Brihad Diva, says, "Make me immortal in that realm where they move even as they wish, in the third sphere of inmost heaven, where lucid worlds are full of light. Make me immortal in that realm of eager wish and strong desire, the region of the golden sun, where food and full delight are found." And of course, the very learned, clever scholar, but one who lacks spiritual perception, says that the writers of the hymns of the Rig Veda were hedonists, because they talk of food and full delight, eager wish and strong desire. But it is clearly brought out in the Upanishads that one has to have the utmost, the strongest possible wish, aspiration to realize the supreme truth, the supreme reality, because there is no other way to find fulfillment as human beings. Otherwise we remain subhuman for the rest of our lives. So and food, of course, means that which sustains the spiritual life. The word, the Sanskrit word anna, is usually translated by practically all scholars as food. Of course, it does mean food in the ordinary way too, but its real significance in the scriptures is not the food we eat. It is sustenance, spiritual sustenance. that which promotes the religious life in the true sense. Make me immortal in that realm where happiness and transports, where joys and felicities combine and longing wishes are fulfilled. That is what Brihadeva says. Deva means the shining one. Brihad means that which has expanded, the one who is full of light. He talks of himself as the foremost of light winners. He rules the great self-luminous fold of light, and all the doors of light hath he thrown open. Now, let us look at the Buddha's assurance. A Brahman comes to him and asks him various questions, and he answers them all. And towards the end of that discourse, the Buddha says, now it may be, Pottapada, that was his name, Pottapada, that you think evil dispositions may be put away, the dispositions that tend to purification may increase, one may continue to see face to face and by himself come to realize the full perfection and grandeur of wisdom, but one may continue sad. Now that, Pottapada, would not be accurate judgment. When such conditions are fulfilled, then there will be joy and happiness and peace, and in continual mindfulness and self-mastery, one will dwell at ease. Then again, later on, the Buddha gives the mandate to his disciples. I'll tell you what it is. He says to his disciples, you who have learnt the great truths from me, who have practiced and proved to yourselves that these are the great truths, do you go forth and teach the many folk for their happiness and well-being. He repeats that several times during the course of his life. Go forth and teach these truths for the sake of the happiness of the many folk, the masses, as we would say in modern times. Now, one of the five major religions of the world is Zarathustrianism. The prophet of Iran, Zarathustra, was the prophet of Iran. And I think that perhaps in the Zarathustrian scriptures we find the greatest emphasis laid upon joy and happiness. The authentic teachings of Zarathustra are in what are called the gathas. The word gatha simply means a song or a psalm, if you like the psalms in the Bible. Now this is what Zarathustra says: raise up the life of man to the height of bliss, O Mazda. Mazda is the name of God as wisdom. Ahura Mazda is the full name, as you know. And that means Lord of life, Ahura. Mazda is wisdom. So raise up the life of man to the height of bliss, O Mazda, through Vahumana, the good mind, the perfect mind, the divine mind, through Kshatra, the creative power of the divine, and asha, righteousness, purity, virtue. O Lord of life, for my joy and far-reaching vision, reveal unto me thy incomparable gifts. Then again, for whom didst thou fashion this abundant, joy-giving creation? That's a wonderful thing to have said. For whom didst thou fashion? How may I walk in beatific joy, hand in hand with you, O Mazda, and be your intimate companion? Then he goes on in another one of the gathas, thou art indeed he who molded this joyous creation for man's sake. And then he refers to one of the attributes of Ahura Mazda, divine devotion, named Aramaiti. And Aramaiti is presented anthropomorphically as the daughter of Ahura Mazda. And he refers to her as the joy giver. And then there comes a very remarkable statement. Then indeed will I preach the doctrine for thee, O Mazda, when man shall in truth proclaim to the wise that evil comes to the wicked, but bliss to him who upholds Asha. Bliss. I mean, that is the strongest possible word that could have been used. Ananda, as we say in India. He who expounds to the wise the sacred word, the holy word, is indeed blessed. And there's another saying referring to what happens to the wicked and to the righteous ones. So understand, O mortal men, the decrees which Mazda has ordained regarding happiness and misery. There will be a long period of suffering for the wicked and rewards for the pious. But thereafter, eternal joy shall reign everywhere. I don't think any of the other scriptures of the world have that idea presented like that. Eternal joy shall reign everywhere. Now, we mentioned asha, which is virtue, and there is one of the outstanding hymns of the Zarathustrians, known as Ashem Vahu. Ashem is the accusative case. The nominative is Ashoi, which means holiness, virtue, righteousness, and so forth. And this little prayer goes thus. Virtue is the supreme good, the only true happiness, the happiness that emerges out of him who is foremost in virtue for the sake of the supreme virtue, not for the sake of reward. Here we learn that happiness is most intimately interwoven with perfect virtue. Indeed, it is only the good man who is the happy man, and the truly happy man is always the good man. There's something which human beings just don't appreciate, because we do not know the meaning of happiness. We think of happiness in terms of sensational delight, of pleasure, the satisfaction of our whims, our fancies, our appetites, our natural urges, and so forth. And we organize our life in line with this idea. We think so much of having fun, as we call it. But you can have fun without debasing oneself and being unvirtuous. If one looks around at life as it is, it's very, very funny, peculiar. But it is precisely that which makes it very sad. The pursuit of pleasure, of sensational delight, always drags a person down. Sensational delight is bound to be present without man seeking it. We have a sense of sight, we have our sense of hearing, we have all our other senses. Now, the whole world, this joy-giving creation, as Zarathustra said, is constantly pouring out influences which come to us all along the line to give us sheer delight. We look at nature, we experience, we hear the song of birds, the wind, the leaves as they are blown by the wind, the sound of the waves on the sea, and so on and so on. And everything gives us sheer delight. But what is the outstanding feature characterizing this type of delight? It is unsought. Now, this is extremely significant. We don't need to seek it, to search for it. It is there all the time. If we will only use our eyes, we will see the beauty of the sunrise and the sunset. We'll see, experience the extraordinary delight of suddenly stepping out of one of our front door or back door, as the kitchen door as the case may be, and seeing the sky studded with stars, brilliant stars, gives an extraordinary delight. And it's so marvelous. It's the sort of delight that one can't order, that one can't possess. There is no possessiveness in it. And if there is no possessiveness in it, there is no jealousy or envy or any such thing attached to it. So that sort of delight is a truly virtuous delight. And it exists in terms of human relationships all through our lives. It is because we desire specific things from another person that we find ourselves in difficulty with that person, because that person may not be able to give to us what we desire, or would be very clumsy lacking skill in knowing how to give us delight and so forth. But if we are simple, truthful, natural, then everything just happens spontaneously, naturally, and it is utterly delightful. And another difficulty is this, that when one experiences delightful things, one likes to have them repeated again and again. But that simply strengthens lust in us. Lust for sex, lust for foods of all sorts and drink, lust for power, for possessions, and all the rest of it. and that is one of the most destructive influences where true happiness is concerned. You will notice that whenever you experience true happiness, you are always at peace, you are contented, you are quiet. And this is very, very significant. We are quiet, we have not sought it, it has come to us. It's the gift of nature, it's the gift of God, if you like. And we do not want to possess it afterwards. When it is over, there is the state of perfect contentedness, perfect peace. You don't want to repeat it. And in any case, nothing in the universe can ever be repeated. That is the marvel of the universe, that it is everlastingly new. It is non-repetitive. It's something which people have never really understood. So few have come across that fact even. The whole universe and the entire universal process is non-repetitive. It is perpetually creative, and every creation is a new creation. And this is how karma works out. The word karma, derived from the Sanskrit root kri, means not merely to make or to do, as you find in the dictionary. That is an ordinary worldly meaning. But in its deepest significance, kri means to create. And you create anew every time. You don't just reshuffle the furniture in the room. That is not creation. All that we call creation in our life is either biological creation, it's a biological production, or it is psychological. All our art, science, philosophy, etc., all that is procreation. That is not creation in the true sense. In the true sense, creation is something utterly new, something which we with our brains cannot grasp, cannot understand. We can experience that in moments when we are truly quiet and at peace, deep peace within ourselves. And then suddenly there is a revelation. And that revelation is not something which is presented in any particular form. It is a state of consciousness, a state of awareness in which this creative activity in eternity of the primordial creative energy of the entire universe is suddenly, you are suddenly in touch with it. Now, when one practices yoga, for instance, what is the purpose of yoga, ultimately? It is to realize that state of awareness of the totality, which is the divine state, this perpetually creative state. And it is this creative state which is the meaning of bliss. It is the meaning of the peace of God which passes all understanding. It is the meaning of happiness for us as human beings when we have realized human fulfillment. The word human means the blissful creator. That is its ultimate meaning. You are a human being. I am a human being potentially. I am not yet the true human. I am still subhuman. If I were the true human actually and completely, then I would be like God, the blissful creator. That means that this existential being, the I, would appear to others around as just the ordinary fellow. And then I would really be the ordinary fellow. No one is ordinary. We are all a little bit skew-whiff, so to say. So now that is the real happiness. The happiness which is your natural characteristic. Human beings, as true humans, are naturally completely happy, blissful, pure, truthful, wise, beautiful, good. You can't get away from that. That is the actual fact of being a human being. The great founders of the religions, those great spiritual geniuses who realized the purpose of existence, that is to say, the purpose of existence for a human being, they were the living representatives of this. And as such, they were the focal point, the nexus, so to say, of transcendence itself, so that transcendent energy flowed in them, into them, and through them outwards to others. That is why what happened in their lives did happen. Now, they were the happy ones, the virtuous ones. The word virtue doesn't mean simply a quality to which we give the name kind, cruel, cruel is not a virtue, kind, helpful, truthful, honest, and so forth. The name which we give is only one part of a duality, because every virtue that we can name has its opposite vice. You see, our psyche, our mental processes are ambivalent. They are dual-natured. And sometimes they are like this, and other times they are like that. Whenever one's psychical energy takes a shape which is hurtful, harmful to anybody, including oneself, then that is a vice. Whenever it is our psychical energy, that is to say our mental, emotional energy, expresses itself in a form which promotes the growth, the well-being, the happiness of the many folk, then that is virtue. Virtue, I have always called soul strength. The Latin word vir means a man, and virtus is the strength of the man. Now, man is essentially a creature with mind. He has mind in him. And mind, you can interchange, of course, with the word soul. So that the strength of the mind is the strength of the soul as such. And it is this which is real virtue. Our dualistic realm of qualities, kind, cruel, for example, is completely transcended. It is transcended by kindness and cruelty being wholly integrated. The integration takes place through our purification in daily life. And this integration means that the whole psychical nature is so transformed that it cannot take an evil shape. It cannot take a hurtful and untruthful, a cruel shape. It can't do it. So that it always expresses itself superlatively in terms of our dualistic word kindness, mercy. You see, this is the thing. This is why it is important to realize that in order to let virtue function in us, emerge out of us and function through us, we must never think in terms of fighting evil or struggling against evil or getting rid of evil. You can't do it. This which I call evil, a vice, as well as what I call a virtue, I am actually constituted of it. The me is this vice. It is this so-called virtue on the worldly scale. What I can do is to transform the whole situation, to transform what we call vice into virtue. In fact, we don't have to struggle to do it. We just have to let it happen. Now, this is where we'll come across all sorts of contrary views. They say, oh, you have to gird up your loins and fight against the devil and so forth. Right you are, gird up your loins and fight against the devil and see what happens. The devil gains strength and becomes more devilish. That's what you'll discover. That doesn't mean indulge the devil. Not at all. I am the devil. I have to know the devil in me as the devil. And if I really know him as the devil, I can completely accept him. And in that complete acceptance, I can transform him. Because complete acceptance releases the power of transcendent compassion. That compassion heals the entire situation. so that your virtue of kindness, the so-called virtue of kindness in the worldly sense, is also transformed into the supreme, the perfect kindness. You see, this is very important psychologically, because most human beings who care for the good, for the real things, the true things of life, they think in terms which produce psychological conflict, psychological disharmony within themselves. Now, there's no need to do that at all. One has to come to know the thing. Observe, therefore. It is observation which changes both my virtue and my vice into the perfect virtue. It just happens naturally, spontaneously. As I forget the context in which it comes, but somebody said, "Oh man, be yourself." That's what it comes to. See, be yourself. But which self? The self as it is now, or the self which in the process of its transform, in the process of its growth, which always means change, otherwise you stay put, in the process of its growth becomes transformed into the whole thing, the perfect thing. The whole thing is the holy thing. And of course, one may ask, well, why don't we see this and work along these lines? What is the deep-seated reason for it? The deep-seated reason is because we desire a particular result for ourselves. I want to be on the right hand of God when I'm dead. You see? Forgetting that he neither has a right hand or a left hand. And if he had two hands, he'd probably slap me on both cheeks. But you see? You know, considerations about living the holy life, living the religious life, are full of fun, I can assure you. There's endless fun in it, and delight and joy. Well now, it is because we desire something for ourselves. Why is it spiritually harmful to desire something for ourselves? Because when a person desires something for himself, he's cutting himself off from what he commonly terms the not-self. And here is the fundamental root of all conflict. All this is the not-self. This is the self. And I'm conscious all the time of my own self and what I wish and I want and so forth and so forth. Therefore, I cut off the rest of the world, the rest of the universe, in fact. And yet, I am dishonest enough to use the word universe, meaning a one thing. See, you see how it is? So desiring for yourself in the profoundest sense means that you are desiring for the totality, the one total reality. And the context of the one total reality is transcendence itself. It is I who banish God. Put God outside me. It is I who banish the truth, the perfect thing, the beautiful thing. And when I begin to see how foolish I am, and then am fortunate enough not to fight against my folly, but just observe it and understand it, in the understanding of it comes the purification and transformation. And this is healing, making whole, making holy. You know that Christian hymn, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty, It has, I mean, all the hymns of all the script of all the religions, they are marvelous in their deep significance, and they all teach us. Above all things, they teach us what we are ourselves, what we are now as we are, and what our inner potentiality is, what we can become, the perfect human. Look at Jesus inquiring, what do the people say, who do the people say, I, the Son of Man, am? And remember, man, human, coming from the Sanskrit root man, also means mind. The Son of Man is the Son of Mind, the divine mind, not mind as we understand it, a brain which just incessantly keeps on chattering away. That is mind for us. Of course, it has its exalted side when you get the really intelligent person and when you get the genius. But the Son of Mind is the Son of Man. Now, the mind is that archetypal aspect or archetypal form through which the creative energy of the universe releases cosmos out of chaos. That is mind. You and I haven't got mind. We have a psyche. Psyche is a reality for us. We can talk of my psyche, but all human beings talk of my mind, which is a mistake. No human being, apart from the perfected Holy One, has mind in the true sense, as a creative energy. That is why the Holy Ones could perform miracles. And in their presence, so many have actually experienced complete transformation of their own nature and their own state of consciousness. This is the important thing, you see. And I've just lost my thread. I was talking of mind.
Son of Man, yes.
And of course, the disciples said, some say that you are Elias, come back, you are so and so. But Simon, Peter, who was afterwards called Peter, Simon says, thou art the Son of the Blessed. No, what does he say actually? What are his actual words? Thou art the Christ, the living Christ. Yes, the living Christ, you see. The living Christ actually is also represented as the Son of God. God is the supreme creative power, but it needs an instrument through which to function. It needs an apparatus through which to function in order to release a whole universe, a cosmos. And that is the Christ principle. The Buddhists would say that is Buddha nature. The Zarathustrians would have their own phraseology, and the Hindus would have their own word for it, all of this. But so thou art the living Christ. And Jesus turns around upon him and says that it's not you, the ordinary man, who sees this, but you have been inspired by God to see this, that means not merely to think or to imagine or to believe, but it means to be fully conscious of it. When you are fully conscious of anything, and I presume none of us are, otherwise we'd be perfected holy ones sitting here. When we are fully conscious of something, that something can happen at once. God said, let there be light, and there was light. Now, that's a bad translation. God minded, let there be light, and there was light. Mind is this creative power, the name of this creative energy. We don't, can you and I say, let there be a grand piano, and lo and behold, a grand piano suddenly appears? Doesn't. See, these things we don't appreciate. One may say, well, all this talk is very nice, but how does it apply to our practical lives? It's so airy-fairy and up in the air, and so unreal. The fact of the matter is that all this is fundamental reality, fundamental truth. Because what, out of what does what we call reality emerge? It emerges out of what we would call the unreal, the no thing. Out of the no thing, the nothing, all things come. And the nothing is just one no thing. This is a very important thing to bear in mind. Meditate on it. It will serve you very well. That out of the void, out of the emptiness, emerges the fullness. The plenitude is inherent in the void. Now, if the psyche in us undergoes purification, it becomes void, totally void, totally empty. And a person would say, good God, I don't want to be empty-headed. But the psyche becomes empty of what? Of what? Of all that obstructs the light of transcendence. All our mistaken beliefs, ideas, convictions, and so forth, they are all solid blocks. We are human beings in the mass are blockheads. There's no getting away from that. We are blockheads. And it is all that which hinders the light of transcendence from shining through us. And therefore, we are not conscious in the full sense of the word. It's only the human, it's only members of the human kingdom who have the possibility of perfect and full consciousness as such. Now, you who are interested in, those of you who are interested in yoga and practice yoga and so forth, the supreme thing about yoga is precisely the realization of this state of kevalam, the aloneness. Now, aloneness does not mean that we are cut off from everybody else. Far from it. This aloneness means that you are like transcendence, the one only. The alone is the one only. We experience in our loneliness the ill health of the true aloneness. The true aloneness within us, diseased, is our loneliness. Who feels lonely? The person who's concerned with himself. If you're not solely concerned with yourself, you wouldn't feel lonely. Everything would be your companion. The fireplace, the walls, the lamp, the noise in the street, the buses making a devil of a row and whatnot. All that, you would be in tune with it, in harmony with it. This is the extraordinary part of it all. So now, we come back then to the full realization of happiness. Happiness is our birthright. It is the crown of our existential being. The body, the psychophysical organism, is the existential being. And the crown of perfect existential being is happiness, true happiness. You can't avoid it if you tried. Once you begin to see the true nature of the existential, then you will also awaken to the reality of the transcendent. And that is the supreme bliss and the supreme happiness. The infinite is joy.